that, we could still make control on time and let the battery charge.
"You placed your crew in jeopardy," he said. "You are in arrears with child support."
I asked him, was he still employed by GMH?
"There are more important interests in this car."
"Your name is Dunstan, not Shearer."
"Shut up,"
he said, and turned to Buckhuber.
"Your life is a grubby mess. When we win, the reporters will find your wife and son. Do you really want to do that to Mr. and Mrs. Bobbs? You're shitting over everything."
"You've got the wrong fellow, Mr. Dunstan," he replied.
And I was pleased that he stepped out of the car, and pleased also that he walked away, up the road. He picked up a stone and threw it far ahead. I had never seen him lose his temper, but I judged it would be a fair explosion when it finally happened. I told Dunstan to piss off and leave us. It was a first for me.
Chapter 6. The last thing I required was alcohol, but beer was the Bobsies' cure for every ailment, and Irene asked would I please accompany her to the pub because she was not comfortable with Dunstan. I said she should stay away from the schemer. That was no can do, as she expressed it. But we could drink here, she said, meaning the old Larapinta Hotel, of which she had, moments before, been loudly critical. She had never seen a place so filthy. I was lucky. I would sleep in the car. It was true. The hotel was a rough and dirty place, perched on long fat legs across from the railway yards, in a sour effluvium of meatworks and flagon wine. It advertised sea views, and there it was indeed, beyond the broken scrub and grass, the misty Timor Sea disappearing in the dusk. In the foreground, across the street, a sign announced there was to be no drinking, no gambling, no humbug. Although this was obviously intended for those behind the rear sign of the sign, scattered groups of blacks gathered around their smoky fires. Mrs. Bobbsey's presence made it necessary for her male companions to drink in the so-called Virgin's Parlour. Thank God, I thought, when I beheld the public bar crammed with argumentative, hard-faced whites. I wondered about the single black fella in their midst. He looked exactly the same as that battery doctor fella who had saved our skin. It was him. It must be. He was staring at me across the bar. Better leave here, I thought. Then the toxic, sweaty Dunstan told Mrs. B that he hoped she had locked her vehicle. If not, it would be stripped clean like a chicken carcass. I offered to attend to it. That damned stare was waiting on my return, no longer in the public bar, but in the Virgin's Parlour, where the black man positioned himself with his long back against the wall. He raised his beer to me. "Battery doctor?"
"Mr. Red X."
Of course, I shook his hand. A penny flew across the room and bounced over the bar. Only later did I think I was the cause of it. "You got along the road pretty fast. Lockie? Lockie Peterson?"
"Lockie, come drink with me."
Of course, I did not drink, but I wouldn't give offence. I turned to find the wall-faced bartender was already paying close attention.
"Dog tag," he demanded.
"He's with us," called Dunstan. "My shout." "Doesn't matter if he's with the Prince of Bloody Wales. I need to see the certificate of exemption."
"I don't understand," said Dunstan.
"Why would you?" said the bartender, speaking over his shoulder, as he filled the glass of a young woman who had tattooed herself with nails or darning needles.
"Woof, woof," she said, and laughed.
"Look here," said Dunstan.
"It's all right, mate," the bartender said. "I can see you from down south. All I'm asking, mate, does this chap have his pass, his dog tag?"
I turned to find myself the subject of Lockie Peterson's bloodshot yellow eyes. better you come," he said.
"You're serving me," said Mrs. Bobsey. "You can serve my navigator too."
"Show them, Lockie," said the bartender. And the black man paused, considered me, and finally produced from deep in his trouser pocket a crumpled piece of paper which the white man, careless of the wet surface, spread out beneath his hand so I could read. "General Certificate of Exemption. This document entitles the bearer, half-caste Aboriginal, known as Lockie Peterson, 1, to leave Quambi Downs Station, 2, to walk freely through town without being arrested, 3, to enter a ship or hotel. Individual may not be served at proprietor's discretion. N.B. Speaking in native language prohibited." "Drink another place," said the black man. He jerked his weathered, handsome head, whose creases all pointed to the joining of his forehead and his nose. "Much better drink another place. Come langer me." Irene had let her mouth drop open. Dunstan suffered a shudder of impatience. My driver ordered the barman to give me anything I wanted. I fancy I will not forget this moment, turning my attention from one actor to the other, at first amused by the size of their mistake. The tattooed woman had barked like a dog when the penny had been thrown, but why? The barman affected great busyness with his beer gun, while he kept his secret eye on me. "Come with me," whispered Dr. Battery, although that is an approximate quotation, and I'm not sure what he said. Then, and many times afterwards, for his diction was rather soft and indistinct, sounding more like his melodic language than my own. He spoke again, and there was such a bad blood odour in the bar, such malice, that I didn't have to understand a word, only that there was nothing to laugh at. The hotel was built high on stumps capped with tin, and the time it took me to arrive at the dark, sour, earth-floored place at the bottom of the stairs was insufficient for me to grasp my situation, except I had been ambushed. By whom or why, I did not know. I had been set on by an expert, you might say, for it was a Darwin barman's job, just as it had been the Townsville's policeman's, to exercise the finest discrimination. He had read my physiognomy, I suppose, with the same confidence as the previous barmaid who had agreed to serve me lemonade. All this was incredibly upsetting. "You give me 5 quid, Dr. Battery said to me. We drink in camp." You rascal, I thought. I opened my wallet, and as I never kept my money there, it was as empty as I had expected. Irene had arrived at the bottom of the stairs. "Come back up." "No good for him up there," said Lockie. "Don't like blackfellas there."
"Don't be silly," she said, small and neat and frightened. "Come back, Willie. I can't be with Dunstan alone."
"Me two fellas stop here, missus. You give me 5 quid. 1 fleg and 6 beer. Poor fella come drink langer camp with me."
"You don't even drink," she said to me.
"He come back. He stop with me. Look one thing."
"Willie?"
The drinkers upstairs made their own distinct warning thunder, shuffling their railway worker boots across the floor. I looked at Irene's sweet face, her big wet eyes, and saw she was even more frightened of Lockie than she was of Dunstan.
"I'll do what you want," she said. "I'm on your side."
She was so tiny in her pale, bleached overalls.
"You really want me to pay for a flagon?"
"Flagon port," said Dr. Battery. 6 beer, 27 shilling.
"You know what you're doing?" she asked, counting out the money into that large, pink-palmed hand.
In fact, I was about to be a special guest of those citizens of Darwin who this afternoon were gathered at campfires by the sea, just up the bumpy Bagot Road. As he limped down onto the sand, Dr. Battery explained it was not the best day to come, but never mind. These old men had been waiting all day to get that old fellow from the morgue. There they had been met by a big mob of police who would not let them have the body of their relative, a law boss and much respected. The cops wore white socks on their hairy legs. They said the dead man was still a ward of the state. He was a government Aborigine, and they would deal with him dead as they had had cause to deal with him for disorderly behaviour. The flagon and beer were produced, and all seals were checked. Now Dr. Battery, who was neatly dressed in his elastic-sided boots and moleskins, chose a place beside an old, wild-haired fellow sitting cross-legged in his dirty sand-shoes and dusty pants. To me he was courteous but not friendly, but he and Dr. Battery were immediately whispering to each other close up, while their fellows, most noticeably, looked away as if the last thing on their minds was to eavesdrop. Finally the flagon was given to the next man, who passed it, still unopened, down the line, beyond my ken. The six beer bottles were a different matter. They had definitely become the old man's property, and he would dispense them according to a system very clear to him. He opened the first bottle and poured it into a large enamel pannikin. I imagined the drinker's seriousness was all to do with that sad dead body business, so I sat respectfully to one side, cramped, uncomfortable, bitten by sandflies, not grasping that it was I, Willie Barkhuber, who was the object of all these frowns and worry. When I was instructed to illuminate myself, to place my face close to the fire, I was like a drowning man who's surprised to find the distance from which he views his present situation. I heard the soft wash of the ocean and thought of Indonesia out there beyond the smoke. I heard glass break. Two men were fighting by an isolated campfire, rolling into the flames. Lockie stayed beside me all this time, sipping constantly, quietly. He spoke and was listened to and had a great deal to say. I heard the word Red X and wondered if he was telling the story of the sick battery he had cured. I was not prepared to become the subject of examination. It was distressing, the sudden, unexpected touching of my face. The mob held lighted sticks to better see me. I saw them as well. Indeed, some looked as white as I did. A woman wept. I called to Dr. Battery, but it was he who now sat on me, tugging at my shirt, and I felt myself ripped from time and place, and I curled myself into a ball and rolled into the sand, which is where the flashlight found me, and I was attended to by brave little Irene Bobbs, who had come out into the unknown dark to find me.
Chapter 7. You would think Dunstan was married to my husband, the way he spoke. He knew all Titch's secrets, more than me. He was in charge, okay? He forbade me to follow Willie when he disappeared into the night. I would be raped, he said, snatching at my wrist. I would be chopped up with an axe. He rushed at me, then fled the consequences. Wait there, he said. What had just occurred, I did not know, except the whole bar had slammed the door on my dear friend and crew member. They had been ignorant and vicious, like a clique at Geelong High. You're in, you're out, you're not our friend. It was almost closing time. I waited for Dunstan while he consulted with two policemen, but then he raised a glass, the mongrel. Clearly I was on my own. I pushed through the 6 o'clock swillers as they spilled out onto the street, straight into the headlights of exhausted Red X drivers cruising for a hotel bed. I ran across the mown government grass, towards the sea, entering the yellow sandy track which snaked down through the inky Thai tree scrub. "Irene!" Dunstan called. All right, I was relieved. that he was behind me. Better late than never. He's going to look after me, I thought. But no, he handed me the bloody torch.
"Watch your feet," he said. "There's broken glass."
Yes, I was afraid of black people. I did not understand what a police torch meant to those who appeared in its white beam. I blundered around the Thai tree. At last I found the Aboriginals, like photos in life, another race caught in a moment of thoughtfulness. But when I saw Willie, I did not recognize him. Why would I? A bare-chested white man curled up like a seahorse, dried out on the sand. I thought, he's dead. Perhaps I shouted. Immediately I was surrounded by murmurs. Don't cry, don't cry. They been look after that fella. Everyone was eager to lift the white man to his feet, explaining to me, not quite accurately, but very seriously,
that fella go mad, he been drinking.
What else made sense? All the while the waves lapped gently. The smoke was sweet and the air soft and sickly with plonk, but they been look after that white lady, which I was slow to realize was me. Thus we were escorted, nudged, encouraged all the way up to the road, and politely, safely back to the hotel. I mean, the concrete guttering on the opposite side of the road. The bitumen was no man's land. On the far shore stood a moustached white man, who should have been told years ago, don't wear shorts.
"You're off at 4 a.m., Dunstan said.
Thanks for telling me my job. Now he followed me without invitation, and although he did not say a word, his titch-titch was close behind me, like an insect in the night. How could he possibly think himself in charge? I knew the way without his help, up the fire escape, along the mesh-floored catwalk high above the leafy yard, where, between the mud-caked Red-X cars, a solitary vomiter was hard at work. Dunstan followed me inside and chose one of the beds. I told him, get off. That was for the working crew.
Irene, be sensible.
In the toilet I found the bowl occupied by another huge green frog. It would not be flushed away. I returned to see Dunstan had shifted to my bed, hands on his potato knees, staring at the man lying opposite him.
You are clean-sheeted, he said angrily. Did you know that? Everyone else has lost points.
Why wouldn't I know?
You simply cannot drive solo for another 28 hours. I forbid it.
That's for me to decide.
No, it's not. I'll meet you by that old airfield after you've checked out of control, at Berry Creek. We can co-drive to Broome.
We'd be disqualified.
Only if they knew. They won't. Titch will land in Broome an hour before we get there. No harm done.
No.
And then your navigator leaves the race.
That's not your decision. Willie was gazing at Dunstan without particular expression.
For God's sake, Dunstan said to him, make yourself decent. Irene, can you hear a word I say?
Mrs. Bobs to you.
You can win if you don't muck it up. Your business will be famous. Your life will change forever. I'll help you drive until Broome. Once Titch lands, you can check in at control. Then, Mrs. Bobs, I require this fellow to withdraw.
He's the navigator.
He's a bloody liability.
I thought, here is a pencil pusher, wishing to dismiss the most talented member of the crew. Mr. Dunstan, do your bosses understand what you are suggesting?
Bosses? Which bloody bosses? There are more serious interests in this car than General Motors. If you come in first, there are a number of interested parties.
His moustache and open mouth looked like a smirky sea anemone.
Irene, he said, you were very long odds when you left Sydney. You were a great investment.
Titch has put my money on a bet.
Maybe don't tell Titch I told you. We've got bigger problems now. Put your bloody shirt on, man.
Willie opened his mouth wide and dragged at his lower eyelids with fingernails.
He is a black son he has abandoned. He is probably black himself.
My navigator groaned loudly,
rolled over twice and sat upright, staring at me.
"Irene," said Dunstan, "did you understand what happened in the pub?"
"Mrs. Bobbs," I said.
"He is half-caste, Mrs. Bobbs. Don't you get it? He is being sought for child support. He is a known adulterer." "Ha ha!" cried the navigator, and drummed his bare feet on the lino floor. "He has been seen consorting with the worst elements in Darwin. The police know who he is. He's a half-caste, or a quadroon, or an octoroon, or a macaroon for all I care. If you were the Reddick sponsors, would you want him representing you?"
"There's a black man on the 2 bob stamp. His name is 1 pound Jimmy."
"Oh, shit. Get real, Irene. You've got 7 hours to sleep."
"I thought this was Australia's own car. You can't get more Australian than that. In any case, you better leave."
"You want me to tell your husband what you're about to do?"
I thought, Dunstan is a shameful disease given me as punishment for infidelity. "Yes," I said. "Yes, I do." He slammed the door behind him, his brand new heels thumping along the catwalk.
"I'm not black," my navigator said quietly. "I can't be."
He was seated with a sheet wrapped around his shoulders, his thick, fair hair standing as if electric shocked. I thought, who cares what they think in Darwin?
"I know who my father is, my mother, grandparents. I look like my father. I am his son, you see. Why is everybody trying to drive me mad?"
"Of course you're not black. It doesn't matter to me."
"You think it doesn't matter to me?"
Now I looked at him and saw the deep black worry showing on his forehead, the same corrugated frown I had observed amongst the drinkers on the beach. "If you were black, you'd still be the best navigator in the Red X trial." He had begun to weep, slowly, gently, making dirty trails on his travel-stained cheeks. And then, really honestly, there was nothing left to do but turn out the light and cuddle him. "Come on," I said. "Squeeze over."
"Darwin to Christmas Creek," he said.
He meant the nightmare tomorrow. "I know.
872 miles. Then Mardawarra, Broome, Port Hedland."
"I would trust you with my life."
"I won't let you down," he said,
and I would not let him down either. I pushed up hard against his back and I massaged his head, his neck, his knotted shoulders. I made him sleep. Gently, gently, back in the bathroom, I took down the shower curtain and managed finally to wrap it around the frog. He must have thought his death had come, but I carried him outside and left him to find his freedom. I double-locked the door and lay back down beside my dear old navigator. I was all roiled up.
Part 4. Darwin to Broome, 1,200 miles. Chapter 1. Mud-crusted and cracked like a dried-up waterhole, the leading car in the 1954 Red X trial had been broken into. Mrs. Bobbsey was showering when I found it at 4 in the morning, beneath the brilliant stars, its back door swung wide, a pair of elastic-sided boots, neat and parallel, resting by the rear right tire. Someone was asleep inside, not quite snoring. The 12-volt ceiling light revealed Dr. Battery on the back seat, slender ankles crossed, peacefully asleep. It was my unenviable task to now explain, without being rude, that he must leave his bed. The Lord knows, I thought, how he will take this. And yet he woke pleasantly, in no way embarrassed that the normal odours of a trial car had become those of a public bar. Indeed, he was all business, pulling his boots onto his unexpectedly delicate feet and thoughtfully assessing the stubble on his long chin. No, he had no plans to leave. He come you two, fella. I explained we had a Red X trial to win.
Sure, sure.
No room, I said. Now, as he returned his white stockman's hat to its usual place, I saw there was no escaping the strength of his will. His bad eye was soft and vulnerable, but that good eye had a determined character which would make it difficult for me to insist on Irene's concerns about passenger weight and petrol consumption. It had been a long night in which my lovely driver squirmed and whispered and apologized to my back. What torture it had been, to feel so much, to do so little. Around 3 o'clock I summoned up sufficient character to take the second bed. Perhaps she felt this to be rejection. I didn't wish her to. And now, hours later, here was that dear face in public, tilted up to me apologetically, defiantly, showing her puffy, weary eyes, her bruised blue lips, the smudge of a smile as she turned her head away. "What the hell," she said. "Let him come along. He can play the part of Titch." To Dr. Battery she spoke in the form of English used by Southern whites in this situation. "You hide under blanket," she said, and was miraculously obeyed. She wound down all the windows and then settled her neat body in the navigator's place. Now I would drive for her because she needed rest. It was a piece of cake, she said, the first stage south, long and straight like the road from Bacchus Marsh to Melbourne. I installed myself behind that high, thin steering wheel, beside the Edgell emergency rations and a second box, Ardmona pears in syrup. That is, when the starter motor spun, I was in the company not only of Dr. Battery, but a child's skull, the victim of ignorance and murderous technology. As we crossed from the car park to the road, I was aware of that physical object shifting inside its box, and as we passed through Darwin Control, I was overly aware of it, sensing its historic essence like a wrong. Battery, thank the Lord, remained unaware of the taboo that we were breaking. He stayed quiet beneath his rug, playing the part of a sleeping co-driver. Soon I was following the funnels of the headlights down the empty bitumen, pushing back the curtain of the dark until the torn edge of horizon emerged in the east. The bewitching Mrs. Bobsey murmured in her sleep. Dr. Battery sang, softly, with sufficient authority, it seemed, to lift the sun up from the sand, suck the shadows out across the plain. If the definition of desert, away he goes, is an area with rainfall of less than 9.75 inches per annum, this was not desert. But the soil was red, the scrub sparse, and that horizon very, very far away. Later there would be rough conditions, corrugations, bulldust, bone-breaking rock, but for now my only enemies were the hypnotic undulations of the blacktop and the tendency of wandering bullocks to lay ambush inside cloud shadows. The danger was to let one's concentration drift, and, of course, inevitably, I did. I was already dizzy with sleeplessness and a sort of existential lightness in which my self had slipped off like a shade. Of course, I didn't require a certificate to prove to an ignoramus that I was a German. The foundation of my life was not so easily threatened, but like a sodden hillside after rain, I felt the danger of a slide. Yet everything would turn out to be okay, I felt. We would get to Catherine, then Broome. Every mile brought us closer to a stable place, not here. This landscape could never be mine, nor would I have wished it. My treasured childhood maps showed a German village every eighth of an inch, but here I drove 200 miles without the sight of a human being. I could not begin to imagine where that human might rest, sleep, eat. It was easy enough to say, as my dear grandmother often had, that the blacks lived by hunting kangaroos and eating seeds. But how often might you see a kangaroo? And who would conceivably eat those dry grasses or those gnarled trees with their grey branches and rubbery leaves? Dr. Battery's songs did not bring me peace. Each time I thought he had retired, he started again, only pausing during those periods of intense vibration that felt like an out-of-balance wheel, but were caused by the tracks of someone else's bar-tread tires. After a final fierce eruption, he leaned forward to rest his scarred forearms along the top of my seat. He wished to know, were we going to Quamby Downs? Quamby Downs was a pastoral lease 30 miles from Mardawarra. It was on my map, but off our route. I passed him the strip map, which he seemed to read. My country. We had left the bitumen, and now the track bifurcated constantly. Here the map was useless, and I found my way by trial and error, through an eruption of low rocky hills. I thought, we will slice our tires to ribbons. "Maybe you go to Quamby Downs," he said. We should never have let him in the car. In the rear-view mirror, I glimpsed that half-closed eye, that brooding brow. I slammed the sump against the armour plate, and the Ardmona pears rose and landed on the floor. Immediately, Irene's eyes were open. Dr. Battery was at her. "We go to my place, Quamby Downs," and so on, until she shouted, "Christ!" In the rearview mirror, I saw Battery's eyes unrelenting. "By and by," he said. "No bloody way," I thought.
Chapter 2. 54 vehicles were bogged to their axles in a creek bed 12 miles before Catherine. But it was weariness, not mud, that would leave my children orphaned, I thought, as I waited in the Catherine post office for my trunkline call to Bacchus Marsh. I had just learned that a driver, E. Roberts, and the navigator, R. Gibson, in a Morris Minor, New South Wales, had been injured when their car crashed into a tree. Gibson was found unconscious by a Ford crew, who took him to Wavehill Station, where he was treated by Sister Kettle, of the Northern Territory Medical Service. Roberts received broken ribs. Might have been me, I Bobs. Nearly was. In my case, I'd been jolted awake by a stalling motor, and found myself behind the wheel in the middle of a blacks camp, dogs everywhere and dark faces squinting into the headlights from all directions. Irene, you are a danger to yourself and others. "Go ahead, Bacchus Marsh," the reporter said. "Ronnie?" I asked, and I heard his voice, the huge hurt choking. "What happened, lovey?" His response was like water in a twisted garden hose. "Give back!" Then Ida snatched the receiver. She said the cousins had stolen something from him. It might be his best marble. "It was Tom Bowler," he cried, first from a distance, then weeping loudly in my ear. "They bust it with a bloody hammer." "Don't swear, darling." "Mum, they bust it on purpose." "What does Aunt Beverly say?" "She's seeing Uncle Kevin." "Who is Uncle Kevin?" "An uncle. How would he know?" said Edith, not sounding like herself. "Mum, you've got to come home. Please come home. You've got to be nice to Daddy. Poor Daddy, he was crying." "Oh, darling, what did he tell you?"
"I'm not an idiot, Mum. You know what happened. Grandpa died."
"Yes, it's very sad. You don't like Grandpa." I thought, I will kill that little bugger Titch. "Darling, we'll be home soon. It's only 8 more days." She did not hang up on me. She never would.
8 days,
she cried. And something crashed, and then I lost the connection. And my bladder was already bursting, and I kept the Peugeot crew waiting while the operator tried to reconnect. But I think I offended her when, all that water, a gallon every day. After all her efforts, I had to go. When I returned, the Peugeot boys had taken over, and I was told our petrol tank was full again, although it wasn't, as we would later know. There was a good gravel road out of Catherine, and Willie drove, and I should have slept, but I could not stop thinking about what Titch had told the kids. And we were then 200 miles from Broome, and the so-called Dr. Battery was attacking the emergency cans of Edgell's product with our can opener. I was hungry too, but would not tolerate a sticky steering wheel. Then Buckhuber ran over a length of 3/8-inch wire rope. It was then I learned that Dr. Battery was a motor mechanic at Quamby Downs. I lay down on the hot ground and fell asleep, while the men untangled the rope from the back axle and springs. I woke to the news that the brakes and springs were undamaged. I took off at speed, careless of the likelihood that I would crash and die, and my children would hate me for my selfishness, and would grow up believing I had abandoned their father in his hour of grief. We passed the turn off to Quamby Downs. No one asked to leave the car. Soon after that, I nodded off, just for a second, and woke with a fright. I ordered Buckhuber behind the wheel. When I woke next time, Dr. Battery was driving. I was too weary for surprise. Next time, the motor silent, crows cawing. I was told we had run out of petrol, but that Dr. Battery had just begged a gallon from a passing car. Buckhuber was wide awake, calculating that we would be at the airport early for the plane. I thought, I have to drive. But I woke still in the navigator's seat. This time we were stopped in the scraggly outskirts of Broome. Dr. Battery had finished off the Edgell pack and opened the box of Ardmona canned pears. There he discovered the skull of a poor dead baby boy. Who knew this was personal to him? But I had broken laws. I had been wrong way. I was crazy Cartier. The car was stopped at his demand. Now he stepped outside. I slipped behind the wheel and saw him fleeing evil spirits in my rearview, carrying his elastic-sided boots, walking through the dust back the way we came. My problem was not evil spirits. I almost missed the airstrip, not surprising given that the biggest sign said toilets. Behind this was a Nissan hut and a strip of bitumen where a solitary creature, with his gut bulging in his too tight shorts, marched up and down. God knows how he got there before us, but it was Dunstan. "Back in a mo," said Willie, and headed for the toilet sign. Dunstan chased him inside, with what intent I did not care. I would fix Dunstan in more ways than he could imagine. For the moment it was the car that took priority. I would not be criticised for its filthy state, and as there was a tap and garden hose outside the toilet wall, I got to work. There is a definite satisfaction to be got from blasting off the clogged up dust and dirt, the filthy skin of dead creatures, moths, wasps, bees, seeing the crapulous waste pouring from beneath the mudguards. Was Broome short of water? Perhaps it was, but nothing would have made me leave the vehicle unwashed, except, of course, an aircraft engine and the sight of a galvanized iron box labouring through the onshore breeze. Dunstan bumped his way past me, carrying his self-important bum out onto the edge of the strip, and he was still standing there, waiting like a faithful dog, as the aircraft came over a barbed wire fence, hovered in the air, and then dropped onto the bitumen so hard its undercarriage bent. It was about as lovely as a dunny colliding with the earth. Taxiing, the single radial engine aimed straight at us, forcing us to retreat towards the shed. The door opened before the propeller stopped. There were as yet no steps or ladder, and the passenger was not inclined to wait. Suitcase in his hand, he jumped, stumbled, and, intending to run, limped violently towards us. It was Titch. I had not known what I would feel to see him. I had forgotten he was beautiful,
with a grace that could not be destroyed by pain or injury. As he came towards me, I thought, "Oh, Titch, dear Titchy, I was tired and dirty and I stank, but I had no doubt we would now, in spite of everything, be gentle with each other." And then he ran straight past me, and Dunstan too, and flew at Willie Bakhuba, who was emerging from the Neeson hut, with nothing on his mind but how to dry his hands. Titch flies at him, through the air it seems. Soon they are rolling on the ground together. Titch is trying to punch Willie's head, and Willie is caught him by the wrists. Dunstan intervenes, then leaps back, sucking on his hand. It is left to the filthy, sweat-stink woman to hose them down like dogs. Do not say thank you for being saved from your own childishness. No, of course not. Bakhuba was sodden, with his white shirt revealing physical details that were normally hidden. Then, addressing me as if I were an umpire, he held out his arms, like a boy protesting blatant injustice. It was in this state of holy injury he disappeared inside the Neeson hut. I waited. A taxi, a bright green F.J. Holden, left an orange plume of dust across the dreary, half-used paddocks. As it turned onto the highway, it did not occur to me that my one true friend, the navigator, might be inside, and that I would now be left alone, with no support, to confront my marriage to Titch Bobs.
Chapter 3. I had liked Titch Bobs, but I was not going to be locked in a car with a pugnacious little ferret who blamed me for doing what I had not done. The taxi driver left me in a hot street of one- and two-story timber shanties, all hiding their real business in the deep brims of their verandas. Broome was a foreign land to me. The pavement was red earth, the buildings silver, worn down by a century of salt and sand. Shops and warehouses and general stores perched anxiously on 3-foot pylons, awaiting the king tides, tied down against cyclonic winds. This was where I left the Red X map. The taxi disappeared around a distant corner, and I heard a blasting truck horn. No, it was a peacock, strutting down the street, screeching until, before the Roebuck Bay Hotel, it displayed its feathers in a wild, priapic shudder. This hotel, long and low, with a deep veranda, the sort of romantic outback pub you might see in a Drysdale canvas, recalled that unpleasantness in the Larapinta bar. I felt the eyes of the hidden drinkers heavy on me. No, I thought, you will not ask to see my dog license. I became an actor with urgent business in a lane, and I fled into Sheba Alley without knowing what it was. I could not read the Asiatic signs or those particular mixed-race faces which withdrew as I approached. Cheng Lung Dep, boarding house, pay first. Had he not been settled in his Rangoon rocker, the proprietor might have retreated from me too. But he was a desiccated old man, and his chair was slung very low, and he remained where gravity demanded. I pointed at his sign. "Roebuck better," he said. That surprised me, but I could not trust his word. "Better you go there," said Mr. Cheng Lung Dep. But I would not be put off, not even by the smell of drying prawns. I climbed the veranda steps to Mr. Cheng, whose face had more creases than a walnut shell. "What your work?" His eyes were small and dark and very lively. "No work. I want a room." "Okay. Plenty room." He was a little man with strange appendages, fleshy ears as large as abalone. "What work?" he asked as I followed his huge feet. "Meat works?" "No." "No purling," he said. "Purling all gone to hell." By now we had entered the polished shadow of a hallway, and I understood him to be saying that his normal customers had been pearl divers of all nationalities, deckhands and cooks. "Plastic button," he said. The plastic button had killed the pearl shell business. He now had vacant rooms. No worries. "You'll pay now," he said. And his hands were like his ears and feet, and I paid him plenty. But then he wanted another 2 bob to rent a mosquito net, and I would not be taken advantage of. "No net," I said. "Okay, no knocking in the night." I thought he meant no nookie. I agreed. He gave me a heavy iron key and allowed me to discover that my clean room reeked of cigarettes and grog. From the open window I could see the vertiginous jetty and inhale not only drying prawns but sweet wood smoke and ginger. My God, I thought, what have I done to myself this time? There was no furniture except a single cot, and there I lay, reading my savings bank passbook, wondering what would happen to me next, thinking of lovely Irene Bobsey on the road south towards Port Hedland. The Lord knows what she would say to her husband when they were all alone behind their headlights. I slept for hours. So then it was night, and I could see yellow hurricane lamps on decks and cabin tops, the sand dunes blue and black as night. I drifted back to sleep and woke to confront the great mess I was making of my life. I would soon be 27, and I had fallen off the edge again. I was unmoored with nothing to cling to say, this is who I am, with this job, this business, this belief, this wife, child, future. I was not one thing or the other. I had no driving passion for God, for instance. When I imagined my life with Adelina, I had seen a suburban house and a life somehow spent with books. The library, in this way, had been perfect, and in the time I worked with Sebastian, I had imagined that this would be it, that he and I, together, would establish a sensible system of classification. Why not us? No one in England had done it properly. And we would finally build, with our own hands, if need be, a map room where our cartographic holdings would not fit the accommodation offered to the dominant culture of the book. I heard the soft clatter of mahjong tiles and the music from a gramophone and a concertina and beery singing. This is what I see when I hear Heartbreak Hotel. I was so lonely I could die. I had once been a quiz show king. I had been the master of a book-filled house. Now that was lost to me. I tossed and turned, wondering how I could retrieve my poor treasures from Bacchus Marsh. My grandmother's atlas, a painful letter from Adelina, before the Bobsies both returned. Someone was burning joss sticks. The mosquitoes bit right through the sheet. My mind would not leave the list of my disasters. There was one thing I would not think about. By midnight I was prepared to pay anything for a mosquito net, and I knocked up old Cheng, but he would not open. "You're no nookie," he said. "I sweep." I returned to the mosquitoes mano a mano. They were fat with blood. I murdered them. I would fly to Perth first thing tomorrow. Why would I stay here where they would argue with me about who I really was? Who gave a damn about expense or the pain it took to rip through space? 1,000 miles down the coast to Perth, then sliced like a razor across the bottom of the continent, across the Nullarbor. Would it take a day or 2 days? In any case, I would arrive back in green and normal Bacchus Marsh, where I would be understood to be a white man once again. I wrote churning, looping letters in my sleep. Next morning, Mr. Cheng pronounced there was no airline office in Broome. I fancied he enjoyed himself to see my astonishment, but no, he said. Of course, I could buy my tickets from his friend, the German pearl dealer. He led me to the pearl dealers where the proprietors had not yet arrived. Instead, I met the clerk, a young Englishman, a boy, in fact, whose every word made perfect sense to me. How I cherished his clarity. When he said it was within his power to sell me as many tickets as I should require, I reached to shake his hand. He was Toby, He was tall and blue-eyed, with a long top lip and curly smile. How sweet and familial he seemed. He had a veritable Bible of airfares to study, and went through them with a ruler and wrote numbers on an envelope which, although he was shortly to go up to Oxford University, involved a great deal of crossing out and starting once again. Poor handsome chap, I thought. He is a dunce. I did the numbers in my head, and Toby was relieved to hear the total was too much. He crumpled up his envelope and dropped it in the bin. "Honestly," he said, "it's highway robbery. I don't know how anybody pays." He suggested I simply cross the road to the Shell petrol station, where I would find plenty of chaps filling their tanks for the trip south. "Anybody will be pleased to take a white man," he said. "Ah," I thought. "Someone to talk to. That's how I got across the Nullarbor myself." Soon he was busy with a plastic airline bag, which he was stuffing with the contents of the office rubbish bin. "A gentleman always travels with his luggage," he said, throwing in a weighty pencil sharpener that had previously been clamped onto his desk. "Good luck," he said. I liked him. I didn't know him. I never would. Toby was a flipper in an existential pinball machine, a god who sent me pinging towards my fate. "It'll be okay," I thought. I walked across Carnarvon Street to the Shell petrol station, where I did not have a happy start. That is, I presented myself to men pumping petrol, to men filling radiators, to the open windows of men about to leave. I made my request. I found myself inspected and rejected. Granted, I had not shaved. Granted, my eyes were red. But it's a hard thing for a shy man to offer himself up for this type of judgment. I felt myself a relation of that Red X Ford, which a tow truck had clearly dragged in overnight. There it lay against the wall, windows broken, blood-smeared grill attesting to a kangaroo or bullock in the night. I was approached by an older type of gent, a tall, khaki chap, with a big nose and large red lips. "I'll take you," he said. "I can take you as far as the Roebuck Roadhouse. It's a start." Later, he claimed it was my business to remind him. It was not his job to stop, to remember what he said. "I am Garrett Hanger, by the way. I am Willie Buckhuber." We set off in his Morris Minor, which had a roof rack full of tyres, and the back seat crammed with cardboard boxes. He was a public servant, he soon confided, employed in a boring job with the government of Western Australia. He spent his lonely days like this, going round the traps, he said, delivering stationery. Garrett's nose had suffered many years of sunburn, but his blue eyes were youthful, enormously inquisitive. "So tell me, young Willie Buckhuber," he said, "how you got to Broome." Thank God, I thought, he is curious. This will be okay. If it were not for his tendency to engage with me rather than the road, I would have found him an unalloyed delight. I readily told him what I would have revealed to no one else. Firstly, the whole business with Bennett Ash and my dismissal from my job, a story he applauded loudly. "Oh, good for you, Buckhuber," he said. "If only there were more like you." Thus he encouraged me in my recklessness. He had always admired schoolteachers, he said, but we would never have good teachers if we did not allow for genius. He declared that I clearly had that quality, and I confess I was happy to be flattered, and we rattled on down that corrugated road, and I was less attentive to the road than I should have been. I revealed that I had, until yesterday, been a navigator in the Red X trial. He said he would have given anything to be in my shoes. I told him I had a falling out with my crew. He said he wasn't surprised. He had thought of entering, but had never found anyone he could get along with on the road. He had some jokes about expelling wind. I didn't really mind. He wanted Red X stories. I gave them to him. Gelignite, batteries, ice to pack a coffin, cable tangled in the brakes. He loved it all. He thought he and I should consider entering next year's event, and I was careless and happy and agreed with him. Why not? The course of our chatter led us to my father's occupation, and he was again delighted. A Lutheran missionary, he said. I told him I had uncles who were missionaries, but my father was a city man. You might be wrong there, Barkhuber, he said. Well, I would know, I think. You should bloody know, absolutely, he said. I agree. And thus he revealed that character which, presumably, made it hard for him to find a co-driver. He would not give up on this business about my father. Finally, I told him we should quit it. He offered an orange lifesaver, and I accepted. The road had by now degenerated. I observed, as he dealt with one particular creek crossing, that this was eerily like the road from Madawara. Completely deja vu, I said. That dead beast, that broken fence. When he laughed, I found myself annoyed. It's not deja vu, he said. This is the same road. No, this is the road to Perth. The road to Perth was back at the Roebuck Roadhouse. But that was where you were to drop me. Oh, you should have said. I didn't see it. He laughed at me again. Dear God, man, did you not see it? There's nothing else between Broome and Madawara, and you didn't see it? But you said you had to drop me there. Well, I forgot, said Garrett Hanger. How could you? How could you? He mocked, then softened. Mea culpa, mate. La condition humaine, and so forth. But what am I to do? I expected the answer would be an offer to drive me back, but he didn't change his speed. It'll all work out, he said, and smiled with red, annoying lips. The lone and level wastes stretched far away. Part 5. A Fork in the Road.
Chapter 1. No one told me the Nullarbor Plain would be so cold. But then again, what about my marriage? Who would have predicted that turn in the road? 500 miles east of Perth, I peered by the rear wheel and listened to my husband tidying up the vehicle. Translation, chuck out anything that Willie Buckhuber has touched. Any skerrick, any chip packet, caffeine pill, etc. Pecking at the shadow of the other male. Nothing had happened with the navigator, but my husband clearly thought otherwise. This behaviour had begun in the warm red soil of the Kimberley. It continued south to Perth. It turned left across the bottom of the continent, onto these grey, treeless limestone plains. Peering beyond the side of the sea, I could hear the spooky ocean moaning. Sometimes I felt the phantoms surging through the caves beneath my feet. Titch unearthed a pair of Willie's oil-stained shorts. I told him I had done nothing wrong. He threw the item in the dust. This would not be the end. There were always reserves of dried-up orange peel, for instance. He would have chucked the little boy's skull away, except I would not permit it. All right, give it to the Abbos, he said. But the blacks feared the evil spirits sleeping in the bones. I passed this information to my husband. In response, he made jokes about mumbo-jumbo voodoo. He was merciless, on and on. In Perth, we heard the stupid hit parade, a song about a box that a woman can't get rid of. He never heard a song so funny, especially when he changed the words. As I strolled one morning on Bondi's tropic shore, I spied a huge Ardmona box like I never saw before. I hauled it in and looked inside to see what I could see, and there was a great big beep, beep, beep staring back at me. Oh, there was a great big beep, beep, beep. It was a mystery. Titch looked like he could sing, with his bright eyes and apply cheeks and that dark, neat hair. You could imagine him a crooner like Sinatra, but he couldn't hold a tune. He never could. Even when I loved him without reserve, his voice was hoarse and broken. Now, on this grim plain, with a hole in the muffler which made conversation difficult, his rasping voice seemed cruel and taunting.
"Take a joke, Irene," he said. I picked up the box and ran to town to pawn it in a shop. The broker saw me coming and hollered I should stop. He took his key, he turned his lock, and shouted through the door, "Oh, get out of here with that beep, 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 before I call the law. Oh, get out of here with that beep, 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 before I call the law."
There were so many verses. It went all the way to the pearly gates, and of course St. Peter would not let him in. I had expected the Nullarbor Plain must be a scorching desert, and I had still thought so back in Perth, even when I had sat in the post office shivering in shorts, listening to Titch on the phone, amusing the kids with new stories of the rascally wombat. He did not say he had run over a wombat, and that we had to pull it off the road, the poor thing, dead and mangy with pus-filled eyes.